This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics, and we just got the latest inflation numbers. It is still stressfully high at 7%, though it has eased a bit. We're expecting another big interest rate hike, and our healthcare system is in crisis. But what is everyone talking about?
Easy come, easy go, little high.
And that, of course, is our Prime Minister singing some Queen in the bar of London's Savoy Hotel when he was there for the funeral of the Queen. He's getting a huge amount of flack for that, especially from the British press. So what does our panel think?
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome Hugh Siegel, a former Canadian senator, Sherry DeNovo, former Ontario NDP MPP and a recipient of the Order of Canada, and David Peterson, former Ontario Liberal Premier from 1985 to 1990. Welcome, everyone.
Good to be here, Libby.
Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so let us begin with David Peterson. What did you think of the Prime Minister singing in the Savoy Hotel? And before that, have you ever done anything like that?
Absolutely, yes. And I think this is so trivial. I think if anybody lets the British press, which is essentially venal, there's a quality press in Britain, but there's sure a tough press in Britain, let that press dictate their life. And the fact that we're so trivial as to even frankly talk about it today or worry about it, there's so many serious issues at play. And I say, isn't it fun to have some politicians with a little humanity, a little originality? And this scrutiny that almost appears to be coming from a bunch of teetotalers is it makes public life very hard for everybody, and it's one of the reasons people don't want to go into public life. This was very human, very natural, and I say God bless him.
Hugh, I mean, on the other hand, he was there representing Canada at a somber occasion. A lot of people say he didn't represent us well. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I think in every circumstance where he was representing Canada, attending the funeral, attending the lying in state, meeting with His Majesty the King, meeting with the British Prime Minister, meeting with other prime ministers from the Commonwealth. I think he did an outstanding job, and he was well prepared. The meetings were focused and constructive. And the notion that, of all people, the British press should be advocating for a monastic lifestyle, the British press, Fleet Street, when a bunch of Canadians staying in a hotel, there's a piano in the lobby, and they gather around and sing a few songs. I mean, it's just insane. And it speaks to the double standard of the British press, who are the worst. I don't give them the credit that David does, who are simply the worst on these issues. And I think we should ignore it. And I would not want a prime minister who sat in his room reading briefing books when he could be for an hour or so relaxing with fellow Canadians who are in the same hotel for the same reason. So I don't take the criticism as serious, and nor should anybody else. But let me give you a prediction. Somebody in the House of Commons in high dudgeon will rise and try to get their name on the front page of their local newspaper by making it into a huge issue, and I think they'll be laughed right off the stage by everybody, including the folks in their hometown.
Sherry DeNovo, are you singing from the same hymn book as the guys?
Well, somebody who officiates at memorials, funerals, and what is much more likely to be called a celebration of life these days, you know, on a monthly basis, probably. I would be, you know, honestly, I've never seen a reception after that is not joyous, that I've never seen a celebration of life that doesn't include some humor in it about the person's life. I mean, this is, yes, I agree with the panelists. Listen, I would much rather have a prime minister who is not, I mean, this is not during the funeral or before the funeral. This was on his time off, sing with his, you know, on his day off, than a prime minister who'd be shaking hands with a white supremacist and never disavowed that. And I'm talking about You-Know-Who, who shook hands with Jeremy McKenzie, you know, one of the leaders of Diagolon. So come on, press, wake up, get your acts together, focus on what's important. And Libby, you said it better than anyone, and that's the healthcare crisis, the fact we can't afford food anymore. I mean, these are the issues that are, and certainly in Britain, their utility bills are the issues that the press should be focusing on, and not, you know, and not Justin Trudeau singing a song with other, with the rest of the Canadian delegation on a night off, and quite frankly, a celebratory song by Queen. I mean, you know, this could be seen as being in her honor. So, I mean, honestly, it's ridiculous.
I have to say, I agree with all of that, except the one thing I didn't like is that the Prime Minister's office saw fit or thought they had to issue a press release after this saying that it was meant as a tribute. That was really, it's like, come on, folks, you know. I don't know. And they do stuff like that all the time. They were singing a song.
Remember the wonderful skit that Her Majesty herself participated in with that wonderful bear and the marmalade sandwich.
Paddington
and all
the Bear.
That's true.
Paddington Bear. That ended by the bear and Her Majesty doing the introductory beat for Queen, who was about to appear out in the open territory outside the palace for the next act in the show. So there was actually some connection, which I think was probably part of what helped encourage that little bit of relaxation.
Well, I don't think we have to sort of try to even to justify this. This was a human moment of a very human guy. He has his strengths, his weaknesses, like all of us. Failed people who are in politics, but by God, let's not be so hard on each other about such trivial things. It just drives good people out of politics and trivializes the important things in life.
Okay, before I take a couple of calls on this, I just have one more note on the Savoy Hotel, and I say, everybody, brace yourself. Do you remember Bev Oda?
Yes.
And
the $16 orange juice that got her in trouble, I believe, at the Savoy Hotel. Some enterprising, I don't know if it'll be a reporter or what, is going to find out the cost of the cocktails there. That's the next thing.
So I read that he and the Canadians were in something called the Corinthian Hotel. So I'm not sure which is accurate.
Well, no, this bar was in the Savoy.
Well, I remind you, I mean, these things become a metaphor for spending, and that's what happened to poor Bev, and it was unfortunate, but everybody talked about it. But I remind you, in 1919, a government was elected, the farmers' government in Ontario, over the price of a coal scuttle, which I gather cost $37 in the premier's office in Ontario. So,
what's a coal scuttle?
Well, there you go. You see, you're not a very sort of steeped in history woman, are you?
Looking at what the conservatives in the delegation are spending on their cocktails? I mean, that would be my question too, of course.
Well, yeah. Okay, but let's before we put this, before we lay this to rest, let's take a couple of calls. People want to talk about it. Ron in Guelph. Hi, Ron.
Hi, Libby.
Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I couldn't agree more with your panel. You know, this is such a trivial thing. I'm not a great fan of Justin Trudeau's policies, but something was lost in this thing, and it was alluded to with the Queen and Paddington Bear, that she herself had a great sense of humor. So I can't see that she would have disapproved of this. And as I said, it's the British press that's making a big deal out of this, and that should be the end of it.
Okay, thanks, Ron. Let's go to Bob in Richmond Hill. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Libby. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I know that there is a time and place for celebrations and the way you're acting, but I believe now you got to be fair, right? Nothing wrong in having a drink and having a few laughs with your colleagues. Now, if it was Doug Ford, what would people be saying?
I don't know. Good question. Thanks for that. I don't know.
Well, I think the gentleman raised an interesting point. Yet, my experience in politics, you tend to excuse people you like, and you tend not to be critical of the ones you don't. And so you'll find fault. You can give your own team a break where you wouldn't give it to the other person. That just is kind of common in this business. But I'm glad on this point, at least, everybody gives the prime minister a bit of a break, because it's, we've all gone through this stuff and realize how totally trivial it is.
Okay, well then let's move on and talk about something else. I don't know if this is trivial or not. A poll, a Léger poll, came out, and it found that Trudeau, at this point in time, has a small edge on the new Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, as a preferred leader in Canada. I don't know if that's a surprise to this, if there's any surprise. I know that a lot of people are saying, hey, Trudeau, your time is up and you better watch out for this guy. So, Hugh, what is your reaction to that poll?
Well, Libby, generally speaking, when a political party is going through a leadership process, so it has no leader, that political party does better in the polls than the existing government. Classically, parties going through a leadership process are not in government, they're in opposition. And that's because everybody in the country who would like something better from the government or disagrees with something that the government's doing can find whatever they want aspirationally in that party that has not yet found a leader. The minute they find a leader, however, over, let's say, the next 6 months, there'll be an assessment of the performance, the apparent intellectual integrity, the competence, and all the rest of the new Conservative leader. And people will come to their conclusions. And I think that is probably going to produce numbers that are more substantive and important than the one that was just taken by Léger. And I'm not surprised that the government maintains a modest lead on a series of fronts. And we've had this discussion before on this panel, on a series of fronts, whether it's dental care, whether it's support for different aspects of folks who live in low-income circumstances, the government is sending very constructive messages. Their challenge, of course, will be their ability to deliver in a way that actually makes a positive impact. So I think we have to see how some of that gels before we get a sense of where the two major competitors in the House of Commons really sit.
David, what's your view of that? There are a lot of people who are saying Pierre Poilievre will never resonate with, you know, the vast majority of centrist Canadians. Are you comforted by this poll or not?
2 points. I think I'm surprised. I thought he would have been doing better in the polls because he had so much publicity and the focus of the country was on this guy and the phenomenon, this quite extraordinary leadership campaign he led, and he pulled in an awful lot of people. And number two, lots of people are not that fond of Trudeau at the moment, and he carries all the barnacles of the ship of state, of inflation and alienation, and there's just a myriad of very, very difficult issues in this country. And it's, most people take them out on the government, so it's very easy to hope for something else. And I would have thought that Poilievre was going to do better. Now, that being said, I think polls almost corrupt politics. And I'm not saying we should ban them, although I would if we could, but you can't. Because what happens is these polls tell you about today's wishes. They don't talk about tomorrow's needs. And they focus the attention on just today and not tomorrow. So I think Hugh's right. You've got to take a long-term view of this. This poll is of no consequence. There are things in 6 months or a year when we test these two people going at each other. And by the way, I think it's going to be a very interesting contest. I don't underestimate the capacity to communicate that Mr. Polyev has, and he's tough, and he can go for the juggler. But I tell you this, you underestimate Justin Trudeau if you don't know how tough he is. And you're going to see two young, energetic, capable people going at each other, I think, hammer and tong, and it's going to be a very interesting contest as we sit on the sidelines and watch.
Sherry DeNovo, will the NDP leader Jagmeet Singh get lost in this contest?
Well, that remains to be seen. And I would concur with my two panelists, friends, that, first of all, there are some jurisdictions that don't allow polls leading up to an election for the very reason that David spoke about, because polls influence as well as reflect. And that's kind of unfair, depending on who the pollster is. I put my trust usually in aggregate polls, not in one-offs. For example, Abacus just came out with a poll that showed only 29% of Canadians, and this is a week out from the leadership coronation of Polyev, that only 29% of Canadians feel positively about him. So, I mean, that to me has more resonance than the leadership numbers, because quite frankly, Trudeau has been not a favorite leader for quite a while now and still won an election, you know? It's a snapshot. It's a snapshot on a journey that's still years in the making. So we shall see what happens. I think, generally speaking, there is a move globally to move away from the center to more of the left versus right political voices. And whatever we may think of that, that just seems to globally be the move. So it will really, I think, hinge on what the Liberals do, what Trudeau does. Is he going to veer left, as Liberals tend to do, and certainly in an election, and govern right, unfortunately, from my perspective, when they get elected? Or will, the Liberals move left, or will they try to move more towards Polyev, which I think would be a terrible mistake at this point. So I'm very interested, as my fellow panelists said, I'm very interested in this contest. I think it'll be lots of fun to watch question period, at least for the first few. And I think we'll see is the answer to the polling. Let's wait for another 20, 30 polls.
Okay. We've just had the 10 days of mourning. So many people were transfixed by the spectacle. I mean, really, it was an ongoing spectacle unlike any other. Are there any trails from it, Hugh Siegel? Are people going to be thinking about the monarchy? I mean, the Prime Minister said no, he doesn't want to reconsider it. We always hear about how difficult it would be. Or is it, was it a 10-day thing and everybody will kind of move on, not think about it?
Interestingly enough, I think that the way in which the funeral was dealt with and the days of mourning and the massive coverage and, quite frankly, the evidence of hundreds of thousands of Britons, millions, being involved on a daily basis, standing out in the street, lots of Canadians with them, to be there for the laying in state and for the passage of the gun carriage. I think it all speaks to a deep belief in the value of a measure of tradition and stability, and of course the value of constitutional monarchy, which means the monarch has no authority whatsoever. It has a very modest, he or she has a very modest certifying role. but all the decisions are made by democratically elected politicians in the parliamentary sense. So I think that system has been, to some extent, legitimized and made more powerful in terms of its appeal by all of this. This will not limit the Republican folks in our country and other Commonwealth countries, and those who want to get rid of Her Majesty as their head of state and prefer to go, as Barbados did, to a local politician who they make into their president, elected by parliamentarians, not by the voters at large. So that will happen, but I don't think it'll change the fundamental political economics of a constitutional monarchy being an efficient, democratic, parliamentary way of sustaining democracy, civility, balance, and the rule of law. And I'm much happier, frankly, when a police officer or an attorney, a crown attorney, or a member of the armed forces is acting on behalf of the crown, as opposed to on behalf of some politician who decides that they are really his emissaries or her emissaries. And I think that's something which all of this last period of time gave us illustrations of in a very constructive way.
Well, I'm sure that would have been the point, at least partially, of, again, this unprecedented, huge spectacle. David Peterson, do you agree?
Well, first of all, you have to agree that nobody on earth does ceremony better than the British.
Uh-huh. I agree.
Number two, she was probably the most recognized person on earth. Billions turned into this ceremony. And in many ways, you can argue about the cost and the extravagance, but you can say brought out the best of us. And she was an extraordinary woman. She stood up to scrutiny for 70 years and rarely put a foot wrong and represented all those things that Hugh talked about eloquently. And she did it with grace and dignity and charm. And so, but the next occupant of the is going to have a big shoes to fill, because it's very much a personal relationship. There are two ways of looking at this: the personal relationship between the average citizen of Britain and the Commonwealth, and his or her Majesty. And then you look at the institution, and I think there's going to be, in sooner rather than later, more people saying, well, we've gone through this wonderful period with this wonderful woman, but is it really what we want? There's lots of people, apart from the stability argument, and it is right. Having a head of state that is not subject to the whims of democratic vicissitudes is one point. And the other point is, how do you justify inherited privilege in our egalitarian world? And that's going to be a debate that we will have, not just in Canada, but in the around the world, and in Britain itself, I believe.
Well, I think that debate's been going on for a long time, frankly. Sherry, do you think that this will spur any kind of Republican efforts?
Well, I think I said this before, but Queen was a wonderful person, and she would want everyone to have what she had, which is a guaranteed livable income, affordable housing, and excellent and free health care. So I'll say that right off the top. But more to the point of the celebration, and it is a celebration, to go back to our first discussion, of her life. I think we are humans, and we have a hunger, an absolute hunger for ritual. We have a hunger to celebrate these moments, not only in the monarch's life, but in everyone's life. I think the outpouring of love and the focus on the ceremony itself shows, you know, in the secular world, how bereft we are of these moments of, yes, call them pomp, you know, but these moments where we really recognize the gift of life and you know, recognize those that have contributed so much, whatever we may think of the institution of the monarchy. So I think that was at play here. In terms of the focus now on the new king, Absolutely. I think there will be more focus on, through him, on the institution of monarchy. I think there'll be a look at their history vis-a-vis slavery and colonialism and indigenous and some of the doctrines that undergirded that. I think they'll be looking to him because he's known as an environmentalist. You know, what is he going to do? Where is he going to stand? How is he going to make an impact? So the expectations upon him are going to be huge. And if he plays that role well, if he, again, carries it with dignity, I think people will be very happy to live with the monarchy for a while. If he doesn't, I think you're going to hear more and more stirrings of why are we paying for all of this. But for a moment, as a clergy person, I watched that ceremony and I thought, people hunger for this, don't they?
But you could argue, Sherry, that the church and the monarchy and various other institutions like lawyers who wear robes and to fool the people that aren't part of the same system, use that for their own power and take advantage of people's insecurities to have these rituals where that the people sit on the bottom of and the leadership sits on the top of them. So there's an exploitation in all of this of some of the weaknesses in us all. Maybe that's a good thing, but it's worth discussing.
Absolutely.
So it's time to wrap things up. But Hugh, what are you looking at over the coming week?
I'm looking for the quality of the debate in the House of Commons and in the Senate on the measures being brought in by the federal government to provide assistance to people living near or beneath the poverty line. I don't think what measures that are being brought in are in any way sufficient. I think we still have close to 10% of our population who live beneath the poverty line. That is, depending on how you count, 3 to 4 million Canadians who do not have the ability to pay for rent, food, heat, and clothing in the same month. The federal government knows this. They have all the data that one needs, and they have the ability to do something about it through the tax system, and they keep on evading the proposition by coming up with small programs which are not unhelpful. They just end up not amounting to very much. And I hope there's a robust debate where the New Democrats, maybe some thoughtful conservatives, and a whole bunch of senators engage pretty fully on it.
I'm sure everybody will be looking at the House and the debate there, and we've got to wrap things up. Thanks so much, Hugh Siegel, Sherry DeNovo, and David Peterson.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you all.
We are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about another big issue facing us, and that is immigration. StatsCan came out with some predictions about the number of people who will immigrate to this country. We need them, and half of them will be immigrant families. We'll talk about that when we come back. Before we go to break, let me give the numbers to call: 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Canadians generally differ from many Americans in one important attitude. We know we need immigrants. And according to the latest projection from StatsCan, our population will increase by 13 million over the next 19 years, and half of those people will be immigrant families. And I dare say many of the rest of us will be very old. So, what does it all mean for the kind of country we have and are going to have? And actually, is that number, is that projection going to come true? We have huge immigration backlogs. That system, frankly, doesn't seem to be working that well. The numbers to call: 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And I'm now joined by Giddy Mammon, a Toronto immigration lawyer and partner at Mammon, Sandiluk & Kingwell, and Dr. Monica Boyd, a professor of sociology at the University of Toronto and the former research chair in immigration, inequality, and public policy from 2001 to 2015. Thank you both for joining us. Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, let's begin with you, Giddy. So what is our immigration backlog looking like, and what's the nature of it? Because I gather that over the pandemic, the immigrants were people who were already here.
Yeah, we certainly didn't see a lot of travel, but the Immigration Department certainly has increased the number of permanent residents coming to Canada. For the very large bulk of my 35 years in practice, the annual intake was about, let's say, around 250,000 new permanent residents a year. But in recent years, we're doing 300,000 and 400,000 per year since the current government came into power. And so that's a significant increase. Of course, you know, you also have to take a look at the people who leave Canada at the same time to see what your net gain or loss is per year. And you always have to remember that there's always going to be some Canadians immigrating abroad for all kinds of reasons, for career paths, for, you know, when they get married to foreign nationals, sometimes they move abroad. So that's the situation. From the point of view of immigration, we're definitely up on permanent residents in the last year or two.
Uh-huh. And what about backlogs?
Backlogs, you know, obviously during the pandemic, there just wasn't the human resources to punch out a lot of the visas that people are applying for. So a lot of that work is backlogged. That's on top of the what I would describe as unacceptable backlogs before the pandemic. In terms of immigration and other immigration services, for example, immigration hearings, refugee hearings, immigration appeals, there's a lot of backlog in the immigration business, but it's really become a problem since the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Well, that and so much else. Dr. Boyd, what do you make of this projection by StatsCan? Do you think that 13 million will actually happen, and will that fulfill our needs?
The projection is a sound projection, but it's also based on a number of underlying assumptions, which is, will future governments, regardless of what the political stripes are that they're wearing, continue those policies? Policies are often, particularly in immigration, and I think my colleague would agree with me, are also they're often dialed back or they're changed. They're usually seen as highly responsive to the immediate moment. So we don't have a guarantee that the current standard, which is now 450,000 immigrants a year, is going to persist in the long term. If it does persist, then those underlying results that are discussed, which is growing diversity in the Canadian population, increased differentiation among cities and by city size, are possibilities. They're not assured. The model is simply a demographic one. It doesn't take into account a whole variety of issues that have to do with local immigration settlement policies, economic policies, and the like.
Hmm. Giddy Mammon, do you have a sense of whether this will solve our backlogs or our labor shortage?
Well, we have a very different demographic today than ever before. We are living longer, and our aging population requires help. And we, for example, need a lot of healthcare workers, PSWs to look after, you know, people as we are able to live longer. There's always been a labor shortage in Canada, and a lot of it is due to immigration policy. It does not react well to economic situations because one of the most controversial issues is immigration. The public either loves immigration because that's how they came to Canada, that's what they attribute their success to, et cetera, that's who's built the country. But also for a significant percentage of the population, it also is something that is blamed for a lot of our social ills, crime, welfare, all kinds of things. So it is a very controversial topic. And so it doesn't really react well to economic considerations. It reacts to political situations. And just like my colleague was just saying, the numbers that are projected assume that the current attitude towards immigration is going in the future is the same as the attitude towards immigration by our current Liberal government, which I'm not necessarily saying is going to be a permanent thing in the future.
Yes. Another question that I have, Dr. Boyd, is given, I guess, the vicissitudes of attitudes to immigration, has the pandemic affected or changed any of that? Because one of the things that affects all of us is that labor shortage.
Correct. It certainly has had an impact, again, in the policy area, which is the recognition that there is a crisis in the supply of healthcare workers, enhanced by the fact that under these very intense working conditions, there's been considerable burnout. So there now is discussion and actual implementation of policies to try and expedite the use of immigrant labor that is already in the country. Many of them are temporary workers, many of them are actually, and I think my colleague would support me on this, refugee claimants who are in waiting, and the attempt has been made to give people work permits so that they can go and work in the health sector. There's no question that if you grow immigration and you are focused in particular on admitting people to work in certain sectors of the economy, like the health sector, that increasing admissions will increase that labor supply. That said, there are a whole bunch of issues that you then do need to address, which is what are the contexts of reception? What is the housing for these workers? What's the economic integration and livelihood for these workers? What are the language capabilities and language training programs for these workers? So to simply start off with a large number of admissions and then argue that it's going to enable us to get healthcare workers, that enabling is true, but I think it also raises other issues.
Okay, well, it seems that certainly municipal and some provincial politicians are really engaged in the housing crisis, and that's one of the things. Immigrant or not, but, you know, people who are working in Toronto can't necessarily afford to live here, which is, I guess, a problem going forward, Giddy.
You're right. They're not just moving out of the cities. We're also seeing a lot of Canadians moving out of the country. What we're seeing is today, because of the pandemic, people have learned that they don't actually have to be working in downtown Toronto to have a good job. They could live out in the country, and many of them, could live out of Canada completely. They can
not if they're personal support workers.
Right. There's personal support workers obviously can't, but there's a lot of professionals that I've seen over the last year or two who've moved, for example, to the United States, to Florida, to Texas. They're keeping their Canadian employment. They're working from abroad, but they're not physically here in Canada. And because Canadians can travel anywhere, you could basically take a laptop today and go to the country of your dreams, sort of some remote island somewhere. And you could make Canadian money and spend it in an economy where that money goes very far. So we are seeing people moving away from the cities and even out of the country as a result of the new technology that allows us to work from home and work away from the office, for sure.
Yeah, but that's not the kind of immigration we were talking about. We're going to take a break. Let me give the numbers out again. And I'd like to know, most of us our families immigrated. So where did your family come from? And what do you think of the prospect that by 2041, half the population will be immigrant families and their children? We already have a very diverse country. We'll talk about that. And also, where are those immigrants coming from? 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And we will be right.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. We are talking about the latest demographic projections, and this is from StatsCan, and it could have a big impact on our lives if it pans out the same way. And that is that over the next 19 years, another 13 million people will be in Canada, and half of them will be immigrant families. We're already really diverse. Giddy, I believe that right now the two main countries that immigrants come from are India and the Philippines. Am I right?
That's right. China would also be one of our major source countries as well.
Mm-hmm. Has there been any kind of crackdown there? Certainly, we're not seeing the number of actually Canadians coming home from Hong Kong as I would have expected.
No, our immigration system doesn't really look at nationality. It looks at either family relationships, for example, if you're being sponsored by a relative, or your work experience and your professional qualifications. So whether you come from China or Poland or whatever, there's really no difference in terms of your nationality not having any impact on the ultimate decision.
Uh-huh. Those people obviously are hoping for a better life here.
For sure. And the ones who are choosing to come to Canada consistently over the last several years are, like we said, India, the Philippines, and China. Because once a critical mass is created here in Canada, it attracts more people. So if you have a large Chinese population in Canada, it makes sense that you will have a continued interest from the Chinese community to come here to reunite with family that are here, because there's communities here. There's, there's an abundance of infrastructure for that community. So right now, India, China, and the Philippines are leading that inflow.
Well, yeah, and it's also a question of culture, Dr. Boyd. So given that these are already very large communities here, do you see a big change in culture coming as a result of this?
Well, I think you've got to be very careful in talking about culture. It's a concept into which many meanings can be poured. So I'd like you to reframe that question. I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, we have lots of immigrant communities here. They bring their traditions, they bring their food. And it's one reason I would imagine that other immigrants want to come here, because they can hang on to their culture or when they come to Canada, if there's another large community here. No?
That's true. I would tend to argue that it's also it's not just the comfort of creating a little India. It's also what your networks are. That if you know somebody who's been through the immigration process, they can serve as sources of information. They can also serve as sources of information about jobs. And so having large immigrant communities can actually be very helpful to the people who are seeking to immigrate. Immigrant communities can also serve as sources of information about integrating into Canada. I would point out, though, that there's a danger in terms of making what is perhaps the next leap, which is to say that these communities are bounded by cultures and represent something extremely distinctive from the Canadian perspective, whatever that may be. Communities are, you know, what constitutes, basically these communities are constantly in a state of flux, if for no reason that they have children who are Canadian born, and the children who are Canadian born go through the Canadian school system, develop a different and somewhat deeper understanding of what culture is, and are in fact fairly embracive of the major Canadian institutions. So I think that we don't need to be worried about the culture of immigrant communities, but we rather need to see them as sources of assistance to other immigrants who may want to enter Canada. That said, it's policy that lets immigrants enter Canada or not. And so I think we have to go back to this overall issue of the large admissions that are being anticipated in the future.
I didn't say that it was a source of worry. Giddy Mammon, I want to ask about family reunification. I mean, that's obviously not based on the economic considerations. The last time I checked in with that, it was there was a huge backlog and it was kind of a lottery system. Has anything improved or deteriorated there?
No, it's the same. It's the same model that has been selected for the last several years. Historically, we allowed in we allowed parents to come in a very different way. Now we have a lottery system to throttle the number of parents and grandparents that are coming in. And the reason why is because our policymakers believe that older people are not the future of the country. Instead of contributing economically to the country by being gainfully employed and paying taxes, they come here at a time when there's a greater dependence on healthcare services, and they don't generate income tax dollars. So that's now limited. And if you want to sponsor your parents or grandparents, you have to enter the lottery, and you have maybe a one in, you know, six or seven chances of being selected in any given year. So the demand for parents and grandparents to come far exceeds the inventory of visas available for them. And that's unfortunate. You know, some people look at it and say, well, we don't have to be kind to older people. That's true. We don't necessarily have to, but it's the right of the Canadian citizen that's at stake, because Canadian citizens have always had the right to bring their parents and grandparents before on a much more liberal policy plane. But today we've curtailed that. It's really the rights of the Canadian citizens that are being curtailed, because they are the ones who are initiating the process through their sponsorship. And because we are a country of immigrants, we want to be reunited with our very close relatives here in Canada once we get settled in, and we have the financial resources to bring them in.
Don't you have to guarantee income for those people, and also covering health care for a while?
For sure. So you do have to cover you have to assume financial responsibility, and parents and grandparents, like all immigrants, have to undergo medical examinations and medical clearances. For the super visa program, you have to even have insurance, travel insurance, when you come to Canada for an extended period of time, or else you're not allowed to come under the super visa. So there are checks and balances to make sure that people who are coming here are not going to be an excessive drain on Canada's health and social services.
Is there any thought, you think, in those restrictions, that our own population is aging very rapidly? I mean, the fact that we already have a lot of people who are older, and we'll have more.
Right, and that's going to increase with time. Our technology is such that we're living a lot longer. Every year, we're living a lot longer.
And that's a good thing.
that's a good thing. But really, you know, that takes quite a lot of effort to take care of older people. And our immigration policy is tone deaf to this issue. I could bring in PSWs to Canada all day long. There is such a demand for them. but we just don't have the policy to back that up. And it's too bad. Even the Living Caregiver Program, which was very successful, has become so expensive, so complicated, that very, very few people are initiating that process. Excuse me. And a lot of Canadians are going to the underground economy to find people to work for their children and their parents, so that they can go to work themselves. This is going to be a continuing problem. And as far as I'm concerned, if the government doesn't get real about this problem, we are not only going to have a crisis, because I think we already have a crisis, it's going to be a real crisis that they won't be able to ignore.
What about the measures announced by the Ford government about giving a quicker path for foreign trained healthcare workers? Is mostly nurses, but also, I guess, practical nurses and PSWs. Do you see any relief there or not?
Well, it's a good policy announcement. Can I see a surge of trade? Absolutely not. You know, if we want to be honest with ourselves, the construction industry and the trades industry in Toronto has a tremendous percentage of unlawful workers in that sector. The jobs pay very well. A lot of times you can get into the industry unskilled, and it's very, very difficult right now to get any home improvements done. Get workers to build, you know, to make windows, to make, to do roofs, to do all kinds of things that our economy needs. And if you try to hire some of the trades, you're going to wait forever. And so again, the government has always, prided itself, on having an immigration policy that brings in, and I quote, the brightest and the best. But that definition is very problematic, because we can't all be professors. We can't all be doctors and lawyers and engineers. Every economy requires people at all sectors of the economy in terms of our workforce. Right now, we don't have healthcare workers. We don't have people who can take care of our children, people who can build our houses and cut our lawns and do all kinds of things that we are accustomed to. And that's because I think we have a very weak immigration policy when it comes to that area and that need for Canadians.
Okay. I'm sorry. I have to cut things off now. We are completely out of time. Thanks so much, Dr. Monica Boyd and Giddy Mammon.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.